are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 23rd, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
Say that again.
I'm Michael Brooks.
Hold on. Say that one more time.
I am Michael Jamal Brooks.
All right. Just
Secret Islamic plan.
Just had to fix your levels.
Okay.
And Michael this Brooks. Is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City on today's program, Karn Ross. He's the founder of Independent Diplomat, which is a consulting firm that advises new and emerging states. We're going to talk about an independence referendum for everyone. Going back a little bit to that vote in Scotland we talked about a month ago, and the broader implications of how we're all governed today. I'm going to give you my final word on Sam Harris. I had an article come out yesterday. I'm going to try to take on all of the responses from his followers that I've gotten on Twitter and on email. Hopefully summarize that debate and explain to everybody why they should care about it. And a former Reagan aide wants to do something for his old boss. Create a country made up of southern states.
This is great. Don't give it away.
Well, you probably have a sense of maybe where this is going. But we'll talk about that more in the fun half. And
we got plenty more.
We got plenty more. We are running a little bit late, so yeah, we're going to go straight to the break and come right back with Karn Ross. Thanks so much for listening, everybody.
Of adolescence leaves my body down freshened. My physical frame is celebrated because I made it. One quarter through life, some golly like thing created. Got rhymes 365 days annual plus some. Load up the mic and bust one. Cuss while I puss from my skull because it's pain in my brain. Vein money maintained. No go against the grain. Simple and plain. When I was younger, this I used to do my thing hard. Robbing foreigners, take their wallets, they jewels, and rip their green cards. Dip to the project, flashing my quick cash. And got my first piece of ass. Smoke up some quick ass. Now it's all about cash in abundance. Millions I used to run with is richer, doing years in the hundreds. I switched my motto. Instead of saying, oh, tomorrow, that buck that bought a bottle could have struck the lotto. Once I stood on the block, loose cracks, produced stacks. I cooked up and cut small pieces to get my loot back. Time is ill-matic, keep static like wool fabric. Pack a bag of things to crack your whole cash.
Life's a bitch, then you die. That's why we get high, cause you never know when you're gonna go. Life's a bitch, then you die. That's why we puff out, cause you never know when you're gonna go. Life's a bitch, then you die. That's why we get high, cause you never know when you're gonna go. Life's a bitch, then you die. That's why we puff out, cause you never know when you're gonna go. Life's a bitch, then you
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Karn Ross. He is the founder of Independent Diplomat, a global advisory firm that advises democratic movements and emerging democracies across the world. He's also a former British diplomat and person who writes and thinks deeply about how the world should organize itself in the 21st century. Karn, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you on. So you have a recent piece in Al Jazeera America called I Want a Referendum Too, an Independence Vote Too, How Scotland's Vote Revealed the Need for a Deeper Revolution. Explain what you're arguing, the kind of main takeaways from this piece, and we'll take it from there.
Sure. Well, it starts from an analysis of what people actually wanted in Scotland when they were thinking about independence. And it was pretty clear that what it wasn't was old school nationalism of a kind of atavistic kind that, you know, Scots as a race should run Scotland. It was much more about a desire to bring decision making back to them, a feeling that they had lost control over their own affairs. And my claim is that that feeling, I think, is pretty universal. It's not just felt in Scotland, it's felt everywhere, and indeed it's felt here in the US, that people feel that government isn't solving the problems that they most care about, and that they would like more control. And so, you know, I then argue that one way of doing that is a kind of form of radical devolution, which is actually, you know, could also be described more provocatively as a kind of gentle anarchism, which is models of self-government and economic self-organization, such as we've seen in Brazil, for instance, where whole cities have managed themselves through popular debate and decision-making involving many thousands of citizens. And I suggest this might be something that we should consider more globally.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get back to the Brazil examples, and these examples are very exciting. But let's go into more first the sort of the failures and what people are sort of responding to, and the distinctions in nationalisms. I think this is really, really important point. And we saw this in Scotland, that the reaction, as you say, was not a sort of, you know, narrow, we want we want a Scottish state for Scottish people. It was, we want to preserve a certain way of governance. We want more accountability. We want more power from the bottom up. You link this, Europe, the United States, there is this kind of global phenomenon. But taking specifically, you went to the French example, which I think is important because you're showing how basically, you know, France elected a socialist president in 2012. The campaign was about reversing austerity within France, and also a broader argument about the Eurozone, which is really hollowing itself out through austerity. That the presidency of Hollande has been a failure by a number of metrics. And in France, you're seeing the opening through this failure, not for the sort of progressive 21st century nationalism you're talking about, but a resurgence of a very old school, very dangerous brand of nationalism. I'd like you to talk about those failures and talk about the sort of dark side of nationalism rising up again as well.
Well, you put it very well, Michael. What I think has happened in France is that basically you've had a failure of a classic liberal democracy, a centralized government attempting to manage the economic forces of globalization, such as investment, interest rates, in a way that benefits the people who voted for the government, ordinary French people. And they failed to do that. Unemployment has stayed high. The government attempted to maintain and strengthen controls on wage levels, employment protection, state industries, the sort of classical progressive, if not socialist, ways of managing the economy to in a more fair and equitable manner. So it's not just benefiting the rich, but ordinary workers and people are also enjoying the benefits. And that failed, partly because markets and investors very, very quickly, as soon as these policies were announced, said, this isn't going to work. You know, we're pulling our money out. And this had an immediate effect on French bonds. So the cost of French borrowing rapidly escalated. You know, this literally took about a day And there was enormous political pressure on the Hollande government, which eventually rescinded these proposals. So you saw, in a way, how the forces of global capital undermined a democratically elected government to do what it wanted. And I think those forces, that consequence, that situation, has had a profound political effect in France, which is a disillusionment with the typical statist French model, and instead turning to, you know, a very nasty, frankly racist, anti-immigration reaction, a very reactionary force in the form of the French National Front, who've shot ahead in the opinion polls. So what you've seen is this kind of crisis of democracy, of the typical model of democracy caused by the forces of globalization, has actually opened the door for the far right. And I think those of us who worry about such things, worry about the far right, need to take this very, very seriously and think about a response other than just more of the same old politics. And yes, we can tinker with centralized policy to fix these problems, because I don't think we can. You know, no government in the West is adequately addressing rising inequality, for instance. And, you know, what is the answer to that that actually meaningfully alters that? The far right, in fact, don't offer answers to that except stopping immigration, which actually won't fix that problem. So their promises are completely hollow, but unfortunately they are also a very, very divisive political force, and I think we have to stop them.
Absolutely. And I think the other important point that you're really getting to here, and that example illustrates, is that, you know, and I think, and people who critiqued the sort of one-dimensional globalization that's been implemented over the past couple of decades, with this very kind of narrow focus on liberalizing certain sectors and capital flows, and not with raising standards, and not with democratic accountability, and not with a countervailing force of local accountability either. People said, you know, that from the beginning, who were critics of this model, and now I think we're seeing it much more kind of broadly felt, is that the old story that it's just government that has unaccountable bureaucracies that don't respond to people's real conditions and lives, you know, that may be true in certain circumstances, but corporate bureaucracy is certainly just as big a threat to the democratic impulse and to people flourishing as government bureaucracy, if not more in today's context.
Yeah, and I think that works in several different ways. I think, you know, certainly the economic advantage has gone, as it always has, to monopolistic companies that dominate global business, in particular commodities and services. Banking is a classic example, which is dominated, you know, by a very few massive corporate entities. I can't imagine it's that much fun to work for these places. You know, I imagine that the ordinary employee feels absolutely no agency whatsoever over their futures, which is why I prefer a cooperative model of common ownership by workers and also customers potentially, where they decide how their entity, how their corporate entity, how their cooperative is governed, so that again, the benefits of agency, shared power, and shared economic benefits are accrued to everybody in the company. And that is a viable model. It could happen. You know, there are cooperative banks that work, credit unions around the world. And in fact, they could be more competitive than the commercial banks because they don't have to offer shareholders big profits every quarter. So I think that's one problem with the nature of the corporation, the company today. Another is, of course, that these corporations buy influence in democratic governments, supposedly democratic governments. Again, you know, banks are a really good example of this. They are essentially writing banking legislation in Washington. They have enormous influence across in all capitals because governments don't want to annoy and seem hostile to what at first sight seems a positive force, which is the free movement of capital, banks that are flexible, profit-making, successful. It sounds like something that should benefit all of us. In fact, it's not. It's benefiting a very few. But unfortunately, these corporations are also capturing our governments and writing legislation that is for their benefit, not for ours.
Well, the one problem I see in what you're saying is that there's no room for Jamie Dimon, and he is a genius. I'm just kidding, Karn. So always have to have some Jamie Dimon material on this show, it feels like.
I'm happy to talk about Jamie Dimon. Yeah, I saw that Chase Manhattan, JP Morgan, was again paying a massive fine this week, as they often do. Barely a week passes without JP Morgan being found guilty of some offense, criminal or civil. This one was, I think, about manipulating interest rates, LIBOR. Yes. I think this was about LIBOR. There's an extraordinary scandal where basically a few banks have ripped off everybody, literally everybody, in a way that is completely unaccountable, and they're paying some meager fine that will barely hit their share prices.
Right. Well, I mean, so in a certain sense, there is some sort of genius, completely unanchored by any ethical, legal, or any other type of tradition of accountability. But you know, so let's go into these alternatives. That's another sort of very exciting thing that you're writing about and talking about. You mentioned Brazil. You mentioned cooperative banking. Give some examples of where this other way of organizing ourselves and governing and engaging in business is in action right now and pointing the way to a different future.
Well, I think the watchword is putting people back in control. That's what folks seem to want around the world, and it's a very natural instinct. People want to have control over their own political and economic affairs, and you know that can be done. And if you're doing that, then you're doing generally the right thing. And in government, that means mass participation in decision making, mm-hmm. And that has been very successful in a city called Porto Alegre in Brazil, where over 10 years, 50,000 people a year were taking part in debates about how the city budget was spent. And a World Bank study at the end of those 10 years found that this has had extraordinary benefits in terms of producing better services for the poorer as well as the richer areas. Porto Alegre was a sort of classic Latin American city, a very rich center, but suburbs of very poor favelas. And it transformed Porto Alegre. There was a fourfold increase in the number of schools. Health and sanitation services were much more equitably distributed, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, this is returning to a traditional, if you like, model of democracy, as they had in Athens, where ordinary citizens were the ones who took the decisions. In Athens, they took it in turns, just as they do have done in Porto Alegre. So it's actually returning us to a much more traditional, orthodox sense of what democracy really is. It's government by the people so that it's for the people. Likewise, in the workplace, again, the watchword is giving control back to workers. I don't think it means everybody gets paid the same. I think, you know, it's inevitable that you're going to have some differential according to skill levels and abilities, but that differential could be radically reduced from the grotesque discrepancies that we've got today, where CEOs are paid 300 times what their average worker is paid. And that differential can be reduced. It has been done in cooperatives, for instance, in Spain, where a large cooperative called Mondragon is Spain's fifth largest company. So this is a plausible business model. This is not utopian. And what it produces is benefits which, you know, not only are these companies profitable and competitive, but they produce all kinds of social benefits which we lack today, such as a sense of empowerment for workers and real equality that derives not from redistributive taxation, but from actually people sharing the benefits of their labor.
Right. Before you even get to the redistribution, you're sort of building it into the baseline in a different way. I mean,
exactly.
As a final question, how do you see the relationship between and actually, in some ways, that's an important question right there, because obviously, in a relative sense, you know, it is quite important to push for a more progressive tax code, as an example, because that's a means right now through which you can address this grotesque and out of control crisis and inequality that you pointed to. At the same time, you're pointing to these models that really could alter the balance and as we said, the baseline of how these things operate to begin with. How do you see the relationship, I guess, between working to reform and fight within the constraints of the current arrangement, the current way of doing things in governance and in business, versus putting energy on sort of shaping just really a different model of doing things. What's the relationship between those two impulses?
I think it's difficult to make a universal conclusion to that question. I think it differs in different circumstances. I think people need to start talking about it, and they need to start demanding it of their politicians and of their companies where they work. That is, you know, it's not implausible that governments and companies could start to encourage this kind of trend themselves. But myself, I don't believe that any government or any corporation run by a wealthy few for their own benefit is going to institute that kind of change sufficiently. So I think that instead we do need to be thinking about building up new structures ourselves, from our local neighborhood, where we might form a group to talk about the needs of the local neighborhood, or a group talking about the future of their local hospital. Politicians are going to have to attend to these kinds of formations if they are to be legitimate and if they are to get their own decisions implemented. Likewise, I see no alternative but to found new forms of cooperatives, the cooperative companies. That is doable. Also, as a consumer, you can choose the better option. You can choose to put your money in a credit union rather than Chase. You can choose to shop at places which where workers are treated properly, environmental standards are high. In New York State, for instance, where I live, the state has allowed, astonishingly, this was not allowed before, but they have allowed things called B Corps, which are benefit corporations, which measure their bottom line both by environmental and social impact for their workers, as well as by profit. Before, any company in New York State that was privately run, any private profit-seeking company, had to purely seek profit. I mean, is it any wonder that we had a screwed-up economy like we've had?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Karn Ross, he is the co-founder, the founder of Independent Diplomat, writer, and really someone who thinks very perceptively about the biggest challenges and opportunities of our time. I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the discussion, Michael. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Hey, freebie listeners. Before we end today's first half of the show, the freebie portion of the program, Mike and I decided to give you guys a little taste of what you're all missing in the members half. You'll know we've been talking about Gamergate for a little bit now. And today I decided to, right before we took calls in the better half of the show, I decided to post an open call for any of the Gamergate supporters to call in and try to explain what their view of this Gamergate thing was. And one of the calls was interesting, to say the least. We thought we'd give you guys a little taste of what happens in the fun half of the program. The members show. Here it is. 719, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Forrest the Great. How you doing?
Forrest the Great?
Yeah.
Hi, where are you?
What's up? All right, what would you like to talk about?
Probably Gamergate.
I want to talk about Gamergate.
Okay, what's up?
I don't like what you guys have been saying about Gamergate. I don't think it's true. And I'm glad that Gawker got canned. I think that's great. I want to take this moment to condemn any violence, any threats, any sort of activities that are uncivil. I think that stuff is wrong. And I'd like to thank you guys for letting me call in today.
Okay, but what would you like to say in terms of why you think we're wrong about Gamergate?
Well, I think Gamergate has been falsely painted as a threat movement, and I don't think that's what it's about. I mean, it's about equal representation in journalism, and I, again, would like to thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to be equal and to call in today.
Oh, no problem.
It's our pleasure. Could you get specific, please?
Name one specific instance that that Gamergate's brought to light, and you can feel free.
Well, the Gawker movement was a big thing. We know that Gawker's been bullying people for years.
Okay,
bullying has nothing to do with what Gamergate's about. What is a single or multiple Gawker writers saying, bring back bullying in a joking fashion when attacking the Gamergate bullies who have been giving harassment and death threats to people? What does that have to do with ethics in gaming journalism? Name one instance where Gamergate has targeted an outlet for not upholding ethics in gaming and journalistic integrity, period.
Around gaming.
Well, if you look at Sarkeesian herself is an individual outlet.
Okay.
What's the point about Anita Sarkeesian? I am actually genuinely, I find this unfathomable. So if you could actually explain this to me, it would really enlighten me. What is the objection to her?
It's not an objection actually to her. It's an objection to her criticizing her potential opponents as threat makers or as violent, misogynistic trolls.
But hasn't she been on the receiving end?
She literally cannot tell the difference at this point.
Because I don't even want to impugn you directly. So, you know, look, maybe you have never in your life.
Oh, I'm not saying he did. Yes,
no,
of
I
course.
Know, so,
yes.
But I just want to be really clear. You don't think that she hasn't, as a matter of reality, I'll give you, a lot of people have tweeted at me because they don't like what I say about Sam Harris. None of those people have, you know, threatened to kill me or said they hate me or any, you know, even if they're, you know, they might say, hey, you're being an asshole, you're stupid, whatever. I can deal with that.
I mean, like I said before, the past few days, Gamergate's been.
But if somebody every single day.
Going after me,
if there
yes.
were 100 tweets saying you insulted him, we're going to come, we're going to fucking kill you. And maybe I missed a handful that didn't say that. Would it really be so unreasonable for me to. Say
I'm signing off, and there's
a significant chunk of people who, just based off of my specific spin on something, are threatening my physical well-being. I mean, that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, I think basically once you get a certain level of outreach, and again, we're condemning this. We're not saying threats are okay. In fact, threats are terrible. But once you gain a certain level of outreach as a public figure, you're guaranteed to get death threats. Literally guaranteed.
But you don't think society is getting to this point now where they're saying this is unacceptable and that has to change? There's many things throughout history that were just, oh, it just happens when you do this, this happens. And that's changed because society has said no more. And this is society saying the internet is no longer going to be a place where this is okay. And that's what we're seeing right now.
There are always going to be that 5-7% in any category that are the lowest common denominator, and they're going to continue to make threats regardless.
But why is this percentage such an integral part of Gamergate?
It's an integral part of humanity, not Gamergate. Gamergate is in any collective. That's our role as humanity.
Listen, I understand that you're condemning this, but I just want to I got to get this straight here. True or false, do you believe that Gamergate was started, its roots are founded in attacking Zoe Quinn over a post by her ex-boyfriend?
No, I do not.
But I mean those are the facts though. I mean, whether or not, listen, here's what I think. Instead of trying to rebrand Gamergate, because if you look on all the different channels where Gamergate is the thing, Kotaku in Action over on Reddit, the Infinity Chan, 8chan, whatever you want to call it, boards, the PR spin is what they call it, is keep saying this is about journalistic integrity and ethics in gaming journalism. And that's what's constantly said. That's what you're coming on to say it's about. So if you care so much about this PR spin, why not drop Gamergate completely? Start this new movement where it's not – that no one can argue it's founded in any sort of hate or anything
exactly
like that.
That's exactly right, because I could tell you
I've got an answer. Let me
– Okay. Go ahead.
Let me explain. Do you remember when Dan Rather had the Killian document scandal? Imagine CBS – because CBS was a movement before Dan Rather, obviously – if you imagine CBS entirely rebranding their platform over Dan Rather's mistake, because because Dan Rather made one mistake.
If literally CBS was created by Dan Rather's mistake, and that's what most people knew about it, of course they would have to jump that back.
Dan Rather was an integral part of
No. It's not
CBS was around way longer than Dan Rather.
It's not analogous. If you launched a media startup, this obviously isn't true. It's just the only analogy I could think of. If The Intercept was launched based off of the NSA revelations by Edward Snowden and they turned out to be fake and the documents weren't real and Edward Snowden was a con artist, then that whole site would not work.
Yes.
Period. And you'd have to relaunch and rebrand. And from a PR and communications perspective,
we don't live in an era of pure truth, though. We don't live in an era of.
Well, I don't know what. I'm not going to go into the postmodern thing with you. Okay, but I'm just saying, from a PR perspective, if you really care about it, you totally should launch a rebrand. And you should focus on going after bigger
CBS
fish and bigger targets.
Guardians should rebrand.
Okay, but we're running out of time We're running out of time here, so I'm going to give you one more chance to answer the original question. I'll leave you the final word here to give me that answer. You've given me so far Gawker, which you're running a campaign because they bullied people, which is nothing to do with the core message of Gamergate. You gave me Anita Sarkeesian, who is a single, completely self-funded by her viewers party who is giving her unfiltered opinion, who is not taking any advertising dollars, so there's no way that what she's getting is in any way tweaked by anyone outside herself or the people that she involves herself with. So one more time, name one instance of journalists colluding with developers that Gamergate has uncovered.
National Organization of Women directly funds Anita Sarkeesian. They're an offshoot of George Soros. And he's funded numerous feminist causes. And there's a notable...
He mentioned Mr. Soros. Get him off the line.
I guess we could end it there because I'll give you the final word like I said.
All right, folks. I think we're going to move into the fun half slightly early today because we've been going a bit long on these M&M days. Obviously, it is time to become a member.
You can do that by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It will take you right to the page where you can just sign up right there. Less than a cheap cup of coffee a day. We're not talking Starbucks. We're talking cheap cup of coffee a day. You support this show, literally you support this half of the show. Because what comes after, it's a bonus, and neither would exist without
you. You allow this show to exist.
Yes.
Period. This show relies on you, straight up. 98%.
You can also support this show by buying all of your junk through Amazon through our Amazon link. You simply go to MajorityReportKickback.com and you will be taken to where our Amazon page is. Basically, you will see no difference between our page and the Amazon homepage. What you simply get differently is that the system will see that you're buying it through us and Amazon will have to give us a percentage of their cut. No difference in price, no difference whatsoever on your end. So that way you get your stuff quickly through Amazon and you say, sorry, Amazon, you got to share with the Majority Report. You could also support the show by buying all that. We're going to do JustCoffee.coop. Because if you want fair trade coffee and chocolates, the best place to get that is justcoffee.coop. That's .coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off your entire order. Leave us a review on iTunes. Just give us a star review, write a little text review for us. It helps us gain new viewers because they see us rise in the ranks. And they're like, oh, let me check out the Majority Report. It seemed pretty cool.
That's how they say it, too.
Yeah. And like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMajorityReport. Follow us on Twitter, @MajorityFM. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/SamCedar.
That's all the stuff.
Call into the show, 646-257-3920. That's
646-257-3920. There was a ton of people tweeting at me about the Sam Harris stuff, and I would say I'm going to cover that. You can call in today, and then we're probably going to be taking a break from that for a little while. Although I guess I can't promise that, but I am trying to. I want to give my kind of final answer. I've heard all of these criticisms. I'm going to re-review again, and so you can call us. The IMs are open. We will see you in the fun half.
fortune I will pay.